Hello and welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. I'm Dr. Squee and this is my show. Very excited today. We've got Louise Jameson on the show. So she's probably best known for Leela in Doctor Who, which she played for only a couple of series on TV, but she's reprised the role in Big Finish form, which are a series of audio dramas they do for Doctor Who. Company bigfinish.com, if you want to check those out. Absolutely wonderful time we had talking. As we go through in the interview, although she may be known most for Doctor Who, she's done so much else, such as EastEnders and loads of other TV shows and theatre work over the years. And we had just a great time talking. Just a really, probably one of my favourite interviews so far, if I'm honest. I've loved doing them all, but this one went really well. I think we got some good stuff out there. And it's a pleasure for me, as someone who used to do a show about Doctor Who, to interview someone who's been in that show and just talk generally about their career, like, you know, open it up to some other stuff which she perhaps doesn't get such an opportunity to talk about. And the way this one came about, I should say, was through the director or producer of an internet short called Stuart and Dumplings, S-T-U-A-R-T and Dumplings, which features Louise Jameson. It's just a little 10-minute short. It's absolutely wonderful. Well worth checking out. Please go onto YouTube and check that out now. We'll put a little link in the episode description if you're listening to this in audio form. Well, if you listen to this intro, you are, because it's the intro for the audio podcast. So I don't know why I said that, but please do check that out. Please check out everything that Louise has been in. She's wonderful. Please check out our stuff. Please go to drsquee.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Please look at the videos we've got up. We've got videos of most of our interviews on our Facebook page, which you can now find by going to fb.me/TheDrSqueeShow with no spaces, and Doctor is a full word. And you can check out our show out there, because I learned how to do that on Facebook. So there's now a little link to that. So please do check them out. Download, subscribe, and enjoy this week's show. And also, this week on Tuesday, so this is the 19th as we're recording this, so the interview is going to be Tuesday the 21st of July. I'll be talking to Andrew McAlfresh, who's been on the Edumacation podcast. He used to work writing on the Jay Leno show, as well as doing Wake and Bake with Kevin Smith, which he also does Edumacation with. A wonderful guy, a friend of mine from interviewing previously. And please join us for that. And we're also in the works of an interview I can't tell you about yet, but please keep an eye on the Dr. Squee Show page and our social media. So that's at Dr. Squee on Twitter and Instagram. And very soon I will be announcing another guest, but we just have to confirm the time. Once they've confirmed, very excited, a very big guest for the show. But that's coming soon. So please do follow us everywhere to keep an eye on that. But for this week, let's get back to our show. And this is my interview now with Louise Jameson. Enjoy.
Welcome to the show with your friend and mine. So tell me, Dr. Squee, who's it gonna be this time? We like to hear you talk and we love to hear you listen. And if you are not subscribed, you won't know what you're missing. So welcome to the Dr. Squee Show.
Welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. Tonight, Squee welcomes
Louise Jameson.
And now here's the man himself, Dr. Squee.
Hello and welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. I'm Dr. Squee. This here is my show. Today, first of all, look, happy Independence Day to all our friends over in America. Thank you if you're joining us today and you're choosing to start off your Independence Day by watching this stream. We really appreciate it. Happy Canada Day to everyone who was celebrating that the other day. And happy haircut and pint day to everyone in the UK
who's able to open their business again and is going to go out and hopefully very responsibly enjoy that privilege and what will hopefully again become a right to all of us. So cheers to all of you as well. If you're in parts of the UK where that's happening today, I know we're on different phased returns, as it were, all over the country of ours. So hello to you all. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you tuning in today. Very quickly, one other thing I will do just before we introduce our guest is to wish a get well soon and congratulations on the progress she's made to that already to Katie Manning, another person from the Doctor Who fold. He's had some problems with her eyes recently. I believe it's her niece has been tweeting on her behalf, and now she's just started to make comments herself on her Twitter. It sounds like she's doing very well, and we wish her a speedy recovery. But now on to my guest today. And you might know her as a companion to the Doctor as Leela in Doctor Who, but if that's all you know her as, then you have not been paying attention. She's done numerous stage shows, including Shakespeare, Panto, Death of a Salesman, The Mousetrap, and The Madness of King George III with Mark Gatiss. In her TV credits, they include Bergerac, Tenko, Silent Witness, Doctors, Toaster of London, Holby City, Doc Martin, and The Bill and EastEnders. In the world of audio, as well as reprising her role as Leela for Doctor Who for Big Finish, she has now been flexing her writing muscles with such productions as Attagirl and directing some of the action too. As if that wasn't enough for you now, then she's also able to be caught in a new online short, Stuart and Dumplings, alongside Mina Anwar. Please welcome to the show, Louise Jameson. How are you doing today?
Oh, very well. Thank you for having me.
Is that intro okay?
Yeah, it's a lot there, isn't it? Next May the 1st, I will have been in the business 50 years. So I suppose it's going to be quite a long CV by now.
I can't believe it. You're looking wonderful.
Thank you very much. I'm also 70 next year. So I think there's got to be, if we're ever allowed to gather in one room together again, there's got to be a big party somewhere.
I'm telling you, like, why do you Doctor Who's companions never age? What is the secret?
You're very kind. We do. This is quite good lighting. I think these internet shots are really quite good for me because they white out all the marks.
You at very least do not age at the same rate that we do.
Yeah, okay. It'll be that TARDIS, won't it? Let's thank the TARDIS.
Nicola Bryan once told me it was due to cheekbones. Apparently that's the secret. You've all got wonderful cheekbones.
Yeah, maybe. I had my wisdom teeth taken out when I was quite young. And they say that helps with the cheekbones. So it's a model's trick, apparently.
Great. So I see we have got a first comment. If you have got any comments, please do drop them in. I believe I've even learned a new trick where I can add it to the screen. So we've got Mike here who said, congratulations, Louise.
Thank you, Mike. Actress.
Love Leela. Please do drop your comments. We may be able to get to some of them, but we've got a lot I want to talk to Louise about today. So first of all, how are you doing with lockdown? You were saying that you would take to it very well before we went on camera.
Yes, I actually, there's parts of it that I really like. I was very melancholic when I couldn't see my kids or my grandkids, but now that is possible. I'm rather enjoying it. And I said to you earlier, my heart is breaking for the state of theatre at the moment. If the government doesn't stump up some kind of emergency funding, theatre after theatre after theatre is going under. And all these kids that are just graduated piling out into what? You know, theatre's part of the tuition. And I mean, it will survive, but how long it'll take to, you know, like Phoenix, how long it'll take to rise from the ashes, I just don't know. But I think I've been offered two television jobs this week, so that's obviously up and running, which is The Secret Life of Boys, which is on iPlayer for CBeebies, which I did last year. And another one, which I can't tell you yet, it's a sitcom, but we haven't juggled the dates, got it sorted yet, but it's a lovely job.
Very exciting. I mean, it has been just like heartbreaking. I mean, with my local theatre, I don't know if you ever played the Nuffield here in Scotland.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
that's recently gone under, and fingers crossed we'll get a new buyer, but it's not going to get a new buyer until it's a going concern again. So it's very tough times.
It's a real catch 22 situation. I think the smaller art centres will probably survive, because there's a lot of volunteer work goes on around a local tiny art centre. It's the big theatres that are in real trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I'm someone who's really like Tom, because I'm so much in support of all these businesses who want to open up. Like today, as I said, we've got the hairdressers and the pubs opening in Britain, and that's great to see. On the other hand, we want to be very cautious. We don't want anyone to get ill, and we
absolutely
want to obey rules, of course.
Absolutely, of course. There was a wonderful satirical letter that was doing its rounds on Facebook. I don't know if you saw it. Saying, you know, isn't it a shame that people in the theatre get up and go to the toilet all the time, and sometimes they get angry, and sometimes they throw up in the car parks, and you know, if only they sat still and face front like they do in pubs, nice and quietly and concentratedly, perhaps theatre could be opened as well. And you think, actually, you've got a point. You know, if you sell every other row, every other seat, and you've got a very, very obedient audience. You know, it's a disciplined audience, a theatre audience. They've come to watch and listen and be still.
Yeah, I think it's the tough decision of, like, opening up with half audiences, like, then price of tickets, do they have to go up? Like, how do you pay people? Like, it's really a tricky balancing act. Like, you know,
tricky.
I don't envy anyone having to make these decisions.
Like, there's no easy answer.
I may not be a fan of all the decisions the government made, but I'm glad I'm not the one making them, is all I was saying.
That's true too.
Yeah. So, like, I did want to start with theatre, because you've done so much theatre work. And is that where it started for you? Where did you first get the idea that you wanted to be an actor? Where did you get first excited?
I was 4 years old. 4 years old, playing Little Miss Muffet at school. And I was rather good. And Judith Black was my spider, and she came crawling across the floor, and I screamed and ran out, leaving my curds of whey smashed all over the floor, literally stopped the show. They had to stop and sweep everything up. And I remember standing the other side of the classroom door, hearing the parents clapping and laughing and loving it. Thinking, oh, yeah, might do this forever.
And I had And from that, obviously, that starring role right there, you know, how do you then start building it from there? You know, and what were your influences, actually? Let's go there first.
My mum was queen of the Amdram. She was a terrific actress. And I think in another era, would definitely have mixed being a mum with being an actor. But she was a 50s housewife, you know, and obeyed the rules and gave up work in order to bring up my brother and I. And look after my father, you know, meal on the table as he walked through the door. It was all very, very traditional. But she had her amateur dramatics 3 nights a week, all the way through the year. She directed, she wrote something, she performed brilliantly. And we've doubled, as I've got older, I've doubled up on some of the roles she did. I saw her play Elvira in Blythe Spirit. I saw her play the mother in All My Sons. You know, so I've kind of jogged along in her wake, really. She was terrific. And I think a tiny bit jealous of me when I got it all, really. You know, I got my career and I got my children and I managed to juggle the two. I'm not saying I did it well, you know. I think a lot of mothers live with guilt on their shoulders because they pursuing a career as well as raising kids. You know, it's a tough call to do that juggling act. But I think that was kind of tough for her to see me having it all, really. I've been very lucky.
It's really difficult. Apparently, you never know. Like, because, you know, the more you work, the less time you're spending with your family. But the less you work, the less money you've got to spend then on the family.
Put food on the table, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's never an easy balancing act for anyone. Like, I think that actors end up beating themselves up about it more, because when you are working, there's an intense period of work.
It is. It's feast or famine, isn't it? And but there were lots of advantages to it. You know, when I was on tour, once I got a play up and running and I was only performing in the evening, I'd tuck one kid under each arm and we'd find a little holiday cottage near the theatre, and I'd some brilliant nannies along the way, two in particular that stayed with me for years and years and years together. So we just went off as a little troop. It was wonderful.
Yeah. And how do you go from like that that enthusiasm and seeing your mum going through it? How do you then start building up your own career? Did you start through the AmDram route?
Yes, age 12. I was in musical. My mum dragged me into a musical. Somebody dropped out. And I looked much older at 12. I always looked about 17 or 18. So she hauled me in. I was playing a prostitute. What was the play? I remember swinging keys. No idea that I was playing a prostitute. Just knew I'd be given this little miniskirt. I know. And then
they'd love that now.
I'm not sure. And then age 16, I left school at 15, hated it. At 16, I put in to audition for all the drama schools. And my parents were saying, oh, absolutely, do it for the experience. You won't get in this year. You're too young. And I was thinking, nah, I'm not going to wait a year. And RADA accepted me, and I started at 17. Very lucky. I mean, they were most of the girls in my class were, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old.
Yeah. And was there a thing for you there where was it that spirit of like, yeah, I'll do it. No, it's fine. I'm going to go through with that. Do you think that confidence and maybe that, if you pardon the term, but naivety to like the fact that most people wouldn't be able to do this helped you get further?
Yeah. Naivety of youth, isn't it? You mean believing that I would get in? I just knew. And I lied, you know. I went with the principal. I went in for my interview and he said, you know, what makes you choose RADA? And I said, well, you know, I think it's the most wonderful college in the world, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I had a dream last night that I was 92 years old and hammering on the door going, let me in. I said, I'm not going to give up until you let me in. And I didn't have that dream at all. I didn't. But he... I think he believed me, thought we would better let her in and get rid of her as quickly as possible.
And so there was a lot of stage work earlier on, it seems. I mean, you did a lot of Shakespeare.
Yes, I went almost immediately. I went into the Royal Shakespeare Company, and it was another 2.5 years training, really, because on offer there you have yoga classes, voice classes, accent classes, sonnet classes, and you're working with the top world class directors and tutors, and I was like blotting paper. I was just agog with what I was surrounded with, and every single night I'd stand in the wings and watch the performers on stage night after. You know, I'd have these tiny parts. Jake Guinetta in Lost Labour's Lost, you know, it's like 12 lines or something, but like Ian Richardson was on stage delivering Barone's fabulous speeches about love, and Beatrix Lehmann there, 92 years old or something, tiny woman. She came up to me in the wings one day. She said, I'm going to give you some advice. This is a bit of a rude story, so I'll beep instead of swear.
Okay.
And I looked down and I said, oh, yes, please do. I was, you know, I don't know, 20 now. And she went, never stand when you can sit. Never sit when you can lie down. And never beep a bad actor. And I more or less stuck to that. But they were her words of wisdom.
Not any great advice, but it also sounds like they ripped it off for a Whose Line's It Anyway game later.
Oh, yeah.
Just to share, we've had a couple of messages in support over the state of theatre, so I'll just put up Leo's quickly. Hang in there. Over in the States, we're going through the same insecurities regarding government assistance for those of us who are artists and private contractors impacted by this pandemic. So a few people just extending their support. Loads of love for you coming up on the page. I'm sorry I won't be able to get to all your messages, but I'll quickly flash up for my friend Anna Manning. Adore Louise, she's such a wonderful actor. As a Doctor Who fan, Leela is my favourite companion.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. These are just soak it by osmosis. I'll soak it in.
So I'm just going to put up the odd message, which will represent it for all of you. Sorry if I don't get to yours, if you're out there watching us right now. And so when do you start to make the move? Was it like pretty much, you said it was pretty much exclusively Shakespeare. What age was that when you started with the Shakespeare Royal Shakespeare?
I think I was just 21 when I joined the Shakespeare Company.
Oh, that's heavy for a 21-year-old as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I know I had my 22nd birthday there, because when I went to the stage door, which used to be like a little, you know, the stage door person would sit behind this cubbyhole. You couldn't see through the cubbyhole for presents because word had got round it was my 21st, which was then very important because the voting age had only just changed to 18. I actually was 19 when it changed from 21 to 18, so I sort of missed out on that. On that great big celebration of, you know, finally being able to vote, I turned 22 when I was there, and then I spent the next 2.5 years there and in Stratford in London and touring all over America. I got my first tour of America.
Oh, tell us a bit about that. In America. That must have been very exciting.
We opened Brooklyn Academy of Music. I mean, when we say we opened, it was the first time the RSC had been to the Brooklyn Academy of Music. So we had 3 or 4 months in New York, and then we went to Denver, and then we went to Omaha. Yeah, 12 weeks of it. One day in New York, we'd all had, it was kind of March time, we'd all had letters from our mums that day, coincidentally. My dog has joined us, everybody. This is my dog. And we all our mothers had said, oh, the daffodils are coming out, you know, March when all the daffs come out over here.
Yeah.
And we went in the next day and the stagehands had overheard us, and we had a bunch of daffodils on each place in the dressing room. Lovely. And it was a glorious welcome from them. We were so hugely accepted and respected and wined and dined. I just thought life was going to be like that forever.
It hasn't been.
Well, on and off. I think actors are very poor jet setters, aren't they? This is what we are. We get these fantastic opportunities where we're flown first class somewhere and, you know, not a bean in the bank, but having a great time.
And there is this thing of, you know, you get to experience going through all these wonderful places, but sometimes you go there, you're on stage, and then you're back again, or you're on stage for a few nights, and it's just all about the work. So you don't get to see, you've been to some of the most wonderful places in the world and not seen many of them.
I know, and the worst for that is the Doctor Who conventions, because, of course, we work from 9 in the morning till 11 at night on those. Yeah. So that's 3 solid days. The next day you're recovering, and the next day you're probably flying home. I always try and stay out another 3 or 4 days just so I can get a flavour of, you know, Chicago or Boston or wherever anyone's been gracious enough to invite me.
And from those earlier theatre productions, is there one which sticks in your mind, one which was a favourite of yours?
At the RSC?
Generally, just RSC or wherever.
I think probably my favourite Shakespeare was As You Like It. I played Rosalind in Regent's Park in the open air. And I'd been to the open air theatre as a child. It was my 9th birthday present, I think, to see A Midsummer Night's Dream. And apparently I said to my mum, oh, that was wonderful, but it couldn't have been Shakespeare.
I think if you're asking for your 9th birthday present to see Shakespeare in the park, that's probably a sign you're an actor.
I know. I used to read the works of Shakespeare, on, you know, with the torch under the bedclothes. It was when I was supposed to be going to sleep. And I didn't really understand the words, but I kind of got the music of it. The music was inherent. It's like jazz. Shakespeare's like jazz. And I think it's so badly taught in schools, you know, it's taught like Latin or something. And you want to just listen to it. Just listen to the music. Just feel the sexiness of it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is in schools it becomes about the text, not about the poetry, not about the experience of it, not that it's a living thing as it should be. Like, you know, that's what I loved about, like, you know, it's maybe now it's maybe even dated a little bit, but there was the Baz Luhrmann version of Romeo and Juliet. I loved the wonder of it. It reminded people that, yeah, okay, like a sword isn't, like, let's make it a gun as opposed to a sword. Like, that's more of a modern kind of allegory for it. Let's show young people why this is cool and sexy and action and all these things.
I couldn't agree more. And it's what turned my youngest boy under Shakespeare. It was his favourite film for a long time, and just beautifully done.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I could do an hour just on your theatre work, but let's move on a little bit to your TV work. Now, according to IMDb, at least, which I've been steered wrong by before, so I'm ready to be, but it says that Marty Feldman was your first TV show. Is that correct?
Yes, the first one that went out. It wasn't the first one I recorded. I had one line, and the line was, "Dead cats turn me on." And my agent said, when you get there, if your line is a laugh line, let me know, because you get more money. So I rang her up. She said, is it a laugh line? I said, absolutely no idea whether it's a laugh line or not. I don't really know what it means. And I had to paint his shoes with nail varnish, as if I was doing his nails, but actually I was painting his boots, and they were on his feet. And that was it. Dead cats turned me on. And they put some canned laughter after it when it went out. So it was a laugh line. But anyway, so that was my first job. My first job that I recorded was Cider with Rosie. And he had four lines in that. That went out on Christmas Day, 1971.
I know you just had a line, but do you remember anything about being around Marty Feldman? He's just one of those most out there performers.
He was so welcoming, so aware that I was green round the gills and not quite knowing what to do, where to go. I didn't even know that you had to wait for the word action before you started. You know, he was made me feel so welcome and so comfortable, and yeah, he was utterly, utterly charming.
That's amazing. There's some people who just, I can't think of anyone I could compare him to.
No, he was one-off, unique, yeah.
Yeah, and told he would never work because of his eye, and look what happened.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was his USP, really, wasn't it?
Exactly, that's the thing. Yeah. It was before people realised that actually to have a difference was good.
Yeah.
And that's what made you the performer you're going to be.
Yeah.
The other thing you worked on earlier on, which I've interviewed quite a few people who've got this one on the CV. It seems to be the Bill, the EastEnders, the whatever of its time was Zedcars.
Zedcars. I played a girl. This was based on a true story. I played a girl who kicked a gay person along with a gang of other people to death, a homophobic attack. Mm. And she didn't throw away her shoes because they were brand new shoes. And they had a bit of blood on them. And she wrapped them up in a bag and put them in the bottom of her wardrobe, and with the view to cleaning them later so she could keep them. And that's what did for them. That was the clue that got the gang caught.
And do you remember how that was dealt with? Because that's very ahead of its time to be dealing with that matter.
Isn't it?
In the 70s, would that be?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, that would be like 72-ish. Yeah, it was. I mean, I had nothing to compare it with, so I don't know if it caused a stir or not, but I remember there being a fair bit of publicity around.
That seems amazing. You know, I know, and I mean this very respectfully, but in the time it was in, like, there's some shows which wouldn't have tackled that because they wouldn't have seen it as a big enough crime to worry about. Like, that was the attitude of the time in some circles, and to handle it and to be kind of busting that crime, it's really quite something.
It is, isn't it? And it's around the time that Brookside were doing the first abortion, and domestic abuse was creeping into the other soaps. I think that the idea that soaps, long-running TV series, have a responsibility to reflect and open debate. It's a safe space to debate dangerous issues, isn't it? Drama. Yeah. I mean, I think that's why it's a... I think that's why it's not a luxury. I think that's why art is a necessity. Because it can reflect, it can educate, it can move, it can entertain, it can, you know, whatever gamut, the whole gamut of emotions pass through the art gallery and the theatres and the concert halls. And it's a visceral need to collectively enjoy, debate, cry. I heard a fact the other day, I really hope this is true. You know those pinpoint moments in the theatre where everybody is collectively holding their breath? You know those moments? Apparently your heart starts beating at the same time as your neighbour in the theatre. Everybody's heart starts going together. It's such a glorious fact. I really hope it's true.
Me too. That's wonderful.
Isn't it? And you kind of know it. You can feel it. You know, in those moments when everything's working together and there isn't someone coughing in the audience and there isn't somebody who's arrived late for the half. And it's like everybody's life is on the right track to make this particular evening spectacular for whatever reason. Yeah. There's about I don't know, 2 or 3 times a year that can happen. Those really special, extraordinary experiences that everybody under that roof feels. I love it.
I mean, I'm just also very struck by the fact that people sometimes hold their pearls, as it were, still to this day about kind of gay or whatever it be.
Sorry. Issues. No problem.
And to like, I love it when we have these examples of how Zed cars and shows of that time were doing storylines like this. It's not something new to cover controversial issues, as you kind of alluded to, in art for a very, very long time going back. This isn't something new.
And also, it's still current. That's what's rather depressing about it.
Yeah.
Those things that we thought we'd debated and dealt with and done with are ongoing globally and shockingly. And I feel like our society's drifting, that the middle ground for debate is disappearing down some black hole, and you have to be in one camp or you have to be in the other. And Twitter, you know, I love Twitter, but it can be very, very divisive. And the vitriol rather than the debate seems to be a really unnecessary route, because it's going to accomplish nothing.
And that one seems to be a shame for me as well, because I remember when Twitter started, it seemed to be the space for debate. It seemed to be the new happening place. It kind of, to begin with, got rid of some of the bile which was bubbling up on Facebook at the time, and it just has gone down into the weeds in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, you can... I mean, there is that block button. Love that block button.
Pretty handy.
But the hint of trolling, I'm like, nah, don't want you in my life. But you're right. Sometimes I follow a thread because I think, oh, this looks like an interesting, and then it kind of dissipates into this abuse hurling. You just think, what? That was quite interesting up to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. To move on to some of the other work that you've done. So you did over 200 episodes of EastEnders, which I believe was over like 2 years. This is what I love about soaps is, 200 episodes, that must have been over like so long. No, 2 years. That's two years.
Yeah.
And you've also been Emmerdale. Now, working in soaps, like as I alluded to with that, is that it's such an intense workload. And such intense kind of work sometimes, learning this script so quickly. What's it like to be in a show like that, which work such fast working pace?
Yeah, EastEnders was very consuming. And it wasn't just the work, which I could cope with. I mean, occasionally they do things like, it was in the days of faxes. You know those faxes that's one long sheet of paper? Do you remember? You're too young to remember those.
Printer reel.
Yeah. And I had a little office upstairs in those days. And I came home one Sunday night and thought, I'll just see if I've got anything from EastEnders, because everything was sent via fax. And I couldn't get in the room. I couldn't get in the room because this fax paper had done this. And I had something like 36 pages of new dialogue to learn in 24 hours before we started filming. So that was quite difficult. I also found the us and them of EastEnders quite difficult, because they were very much management and they wanted to let you know they were management and, you know, keep you in your place. I don't know, something. If one person hadn't done their homework, arrived without their lines learned, everybody would get a memo to go, you know, really, it's not good enough, and you've got to turn up, and you've got to be on time, and you've got to, you just think, well, I am. What's this? I don't want this negativity to come into. So I found all that quite difficult. But Emmerdale was a joy. We were filming on location, and I was working with Fraser Hines in it. I was the first woman to be murdered in a soap. That was a claim to fame. And most of it was on Ilkley Moor. I mean, beautiful, just beautiful countryside. Just had a ball.
Yeah. I mean, just, so if you'll have to pardon my
dog. Your dog's talking to my dog.
You may notice. This is the pleasure of doing an interview in lockdown, as I was saying to Louise before we went on air. Like, my interview room here is now an office most of the time, so it's just working with the craziness of all this. But we will persevere on. The other thing which I've talked to a few people who've been in Doctor Who before is that it's a way there's two very kind of like intense but very different fandoms, I think, there. So like with something like Doctor Who, people who love that show really love that show. Something like the EastEnders, it's more like you're part of the family, as I think people see it, and kind of like when people meet you in the streets, I would get the feeling they feel like they know you more. Like,
oh, yeah, absolutely. I would get letters. I had this letter from one woman going, oh, my in-laws want to come for Christmas and I don't like them and I don't know what to do and you seem like a sensible person. What should I do? And I had to write back and go, you know, I'm not Rosa. My family's as mucked up as anybody else's. It's like, I'm in no position to give you advice, but if you don't like them, don't ask them. I mean, so yeah, they absolutely, totally are. And I think it's one of the reasons they let me go. They wanted to make, I got wind of the fact that they wanted to make Rosa racist. They were going to make my daughter in the series pregnant by a black man, and they were going to have Rosa very uptight about that. In real life, I have a black son and a white son, two different dads, one from the West Indies and one from South Africa. And at the time, Harry, my dual heritage son, was doing his GCSEs, you know, big peer group at school. And I went to the production office and said, there's no way I can play a racist under these circumstances. I would definitely be in a film where I had to play a racist if the message of the piece is, you know, solid anti-racist. But there's no way you can be in like a soap where people identify you so strongly with who you are. Thanks, man.
I was just about to say, I do have to, just very quickly, I'm very sorry to Matthew Peck, whose dog's now barking too. So if anyone out there has been affected by my dog there. And also we got a message from my friend Adam. Yes, it is. My dog's called Benton, partly named after Sergeant Benton from Doctor Who. Partly named after Benton Fraser from Due South, but that's another story. So yes, that is little Sergeant Benton barking in the background there. Looking on the bright side, you're not hearing my other dog, Dottie. She's very quiet and very sedate, so that's something at least. It has to be something really kind of to consider for an actor, because it's, you want to obviously do as many different parts of different parts. You want to represent different people, even people you don't like, and that can be a wonderful challenge to play. But if it's going to come back on you in your real life, that must be really so hard to pick between and to
yeah decide. I mean, they never said do it or you're out. I can't say for sure that's why they let the DeMarcos go, but I think it was probably one of the deciding factors that I felt I could dictate my storylines or something like that. Yeah. But there's no way I could have done that. And if they presented Rosa to me as a racist day one, but like 18 months down the line to suddenly turn her into one, it's like, not happening.
It's such an unusual position to be in, because usually if you get a part, there can be twists and turns to a character, but with soap operas, the change in character can be so huge.
And you've got to do all these emotional gymnasts to make it work. You have to sort of twist yourself into a different skin. It's quite hard.
And you know, to find the truth of that as well. Like, you know, that's what's so important to an actor, is to find the truth of why this person's done this one month or one week in the soap opera, and this week they're acting like this. And, you know, how do you manage to square that circle when you're doing it?
Yeah, it's not, it's, well, it's, yeah, I didn't. There we go. But it was, you know, I did 2.5 years and it was lovely. It got both my kids through further education. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, BBC. So I can't really complain.
And before we do get on to the Doctor Who of it all, I did want to speak about Doc Martin, just a personal favourite, and I did love your performance in that. It, I think, was something, it seemed like a different part for you. And the accent, of course, is always fun to play with, I'm sure.
I got the accent from I had a driver to take me out to location, a woman, and she was local, so I got all my coaching from her, bless her. Because I didn't, you know, I didn't want to come in late, all right, you know, in completely thick, cod accent. I wanted to get it just, so I went through my lines with her every day. She was wonderful.
It's just a wonderful, nasty piece of work kind of character. Yeah, just a
bit. Yeah, you know, I think even when you're playing somebody who's so manipulative and, you know, she probably suffered from narcissistic personality disorder or something. I mean, she probably had that condition. There's a bit of you that has to sort of love and understand and empathize with, I think, because otherwise you end up demonstrating rather than being.
And you know, when you are playing a character, like, you know, I think you're right, it was more to the manipulative side of it, but when you play these more nasty characters, how do you kind of like shake that off at the end of the day?
It's not, I can shake those off easily. It's just like you take a big breath and you're out of there. The jobs I find really difficult, it's normally theatre. I just did something called Vincent River, where it's a two-hander, it's 90 minutes, you hit the ground running, and that's it for you two on stage that whole time. And it starts with her inviting her stalker into the apartment. And you end up finding out that the young lad was her murdered son's lover.
Yep.
And the emotional effect that has on her. That ends with a kind of visceral roar at the end of it, at the end of the show. It's an extraordinary piece of writing by Philip Ridley. Beautifully written, like it's like an epic poem. And I found that absolutely exhausting. It was a 6-week run and I wouldn't have missed it for anything, but I was really glad it wasn't a 6-month run. I'm not sure my psyche could have sustained that for that length of time.
Yeah, we will get on to Dr. Who now, and just to briefly just bring up one of the comments again, it's Mike here, and he's been listening to Leela on audio during lockdown. Thanks for helping me get through it. Adore Leela's development in Big Finish. And I think there's a lot of people who do kind of like just having these characters who now are brought back to life by Big Finish just does help a lot of us, like knowing those favourite characters from our childhood are out there again. It's just a wonderful way of helping us through tough times like this.
I think Big Finish's success is boils down to it's run by fans. It's run by the same type of person that listens to the stories. So every piece is a labour of love. And then you cannot underestimate the writing. I think, you know, the amount they produce and the number of writers they're employing and giving their first chance to, myself included, it's been, you know, I'm very, very, I'm lost in admiration for them, really.
We will get to the Big Finish, and it's my fault for bringing that up early. But like, let's dial it back to the beginning. Usually, I go a bit more sequential, but when Doctor Who's been darted about your life, I've decided. So we'll go back to when you first started. What was the process like of getting the part? Was it just your agent phoning you up? We got Doctor Who for you. What was that?
I'd done the Royal Shakespeare Company, so I was kind of getting a little name for myself in theatre. And she said that we need to get you a TV series. So I turned down all the theatre jobs and I sat back and I auditioned for the Avengers. I got down to the last 10 for Purdy. That didn't happen. But, you know, who wants Joanna Lumley's career? Ha! I auditioned for Angels. That nearly happened. I auditioned for Survivors and that really nearly happened. I was down to the last two. But Pennant Roberts gave it to Lucy Fleming, who was wonderful in it. but he'd remembered me from the audition. So when Doctor Who came up, he asked to see me because he knew that he wanted to work with me. I just wasn't the perfect fit for Survivors. So he got me into audition for Doctor Who, along with 59 other young women. And then that got whittled down. So I was called back maybe 3 or 4 times. And Tom was asked if he wanted to read with me to help find the new companion, but he declined. So Pennant read the Doctor's part, and he said that he gave it to me because I made him work. He felt that I made him work, gave him enough contact to, for him to have to respond. So that's how.
Yeah, and when you get on to Tom there, he has himself spoken about how he was kind of very demanding as an actor to everyone he worked with on Doctor Who. And, you know, I think that it sounds like from other reports that played better with some people than others, shall we say. Yeah, how was your experience when you first
started? It was difficult. I mean, whenever I'm asked, you know, what was Tom Baker like to work with, you can hear the room go, I really want to hear the answer. Back in the day, he was very difficult, but I hastily follow that with we're really, really good friends now. And he's apologized very truthfully, very lovingly, very openly. He's just said he didn't behave very well and he wished he had. So he's completely forgiven. And I love working with him now.
Of course. But for you at the time, how do you deal with that? As a young actor still kind of like going into that role?
No, I didn't do very well. I did a lot of weeping in corners, really. I mean, but, you know, it takes two not to get on. It's not.
Yeah.
I can't say it was entirely his fault. I should have just been a bit more assertive, I think.
So your advice to someone who's got to work with someone who's kind of difficult. I was going to say in acting, but in general, like, you know, how would you advise someone who's got to cope with a situation like that?
Well, the first thing I would suggest is going through the director, going, I'm feeling this. Is there anything we can do to ease the situation? And if that fails, then you go directly to the person. And then I don't know what you do if that fails, except just keep standing your ground. But it, you see, to work as an actor, you have to be, to work really well as an actor, you have to be emotionally naked in the rehearsal room. You have to be in a place of trust and caring and nurturing and development. And it, if that's whisked away, it's very hard to work very well as an actor and yet keep your boundaries going as a human being. It's like you're working in a kind of paradoxical state. It's much better if you can just be completely open and trusting through the whole process. And when that's taken away, it becomes, I don't know, becomes like you've got a, you know, like a discord in your head the whole time rather than harmony.
Yeah. And Leela was like, it's hard baked into the character of Leela that she's a savage. Yeah. And but it was written so wonderfully that it kind of brought out other notes to her. But I think the way you played it, if it was played by someone else with less kind of nuance, it could have just been a very one-note character. How did you inject more life into the character to make it more rounded?
Your writing is your springboard, isn't it? And I think, you know, yeah. Chris Boucher and, oh my goodness, best writer the program's ever had, in my opinion. Well, apart from Russell T. Davis, maybe. Who was the Russell T. Davis of my era? Somebody out there, please write to us now. Robert.
Robert, the one who did lots of horror stuff with it.
It was the producer, Robert. I cannot believe I've come on.
I'm just going to reach in my pocket and hand back my geek card right now.
Holmes.
Oh, Jesus.
Thank you. Kane. I'm starting memory classes tomorrow. I've signed up for a.
We have to give a step.
Thank you, Alex.
To Alex to be the first one. We've got some other people charming. There's a few other suggestions.
I got there. Please note, people. And I adored him. Anyway, when Robert was writing for Leela, there was no problem at all. All the nuances were there, all the jokes, all the, you know, the pauses were almost written in without them having to be marked. He was adorable. Occasionally, and this can still happen sometimes on the audio, you find yourself shoehorned into a an adventure story. So all you're doing is playing the story arc rather than how you react to the situation that you've been put in. And that can be a bit tricky. I might ask if I can add a line or take a line away or even put in a little gasp or a little whimper or something at some point to really know my presence is felt and how I'm feeling about the situation. So I might make minuscule changes to the script. I mean, basically, they're terrific. But when it is just an adventure and nothing else, then I feel a bit, wrong-footed by it. But normally the writers are just phenomenal.
Yeah. And something which I know you've spoken about before is the eyebrow-raising outfit, and it also raised a few blood pressures and I believe a few headlines over the years as well. Yeah, but you said an interview you weren't aware of that though at the time.
I would think I was just very naive at the time. You know, they made her very feisty, very independent, and then they took her clothes off to do it. You know, as far as I was concerned, she lived in a hot jungle. There weren't any boutiques around. What was she going to wear but animal skins, of course? And the men, you know, they just had loincloths. So, of course, she just had like this sort of leotard thing. I just thought it would be fine. But I thought it was my talent that was putting the viewing figures down, not the fact that I was semi-naked.
Well, that's what I was kind of going to bring it on to, something hopefully a little bit more original than that question. But it's the fact that it's the way the press then portrays a female who is wearing something which is maybe a bit scantily clad. It's just, what's your feeling on like the way press do treat women who are just having to be wearing something a bit revealing? Like, you know, as you say, kind of like your acting should be what it is concentrated on.
Yeah, and the way, you know, you would never hear, and Boris Johnson came into Prime Minister Question Times today wearing a blue tie and a slightly off-the-shoulder rumpled jacket. You just wouldn't get that in his description. Still, there we go, and Theresa May wearing her trademark red lipstick, blah, 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 blah. It's like it still had that gender divide is still very, very obvious.
Yeah, there was a guy, I think it might have been another country, maybe Australia, but he wore the same suit on TV for a year to raise a point that no one once commented on it. During the time, his female counterpart, her outfit was constantly commented on.
I know. You know, if I ruled the world. But I do think there are, you know, some battles. I think you have to kind of pick your battles a bit. And if someone wants to get their knickers in a twist over a particular outfit, then that's that. But, you know, if you want to, what can I say here that isn't going to start a furore? I would fight other battles that are more important. You know, as a child, I wasn't allowed to take woodwork in school. I had to take needlework. And that's just it. All the girls did needlework and all the boys did woodwork. And I would, you know, that battle has been won. The girls can now choose. And the boys, as indeed can the boys. So it's all to do with education, isn't it? If you really want to start solving things. You know, my eldest did a podcast recently on, and the main subject was Black Lives Matter. And he was saying, you know, don't give a job to someone just because they're black. Do it because they've had equal opportunity and the best person has got the job. So you've got to roll back to childhood and make sure that the education is up to top notch. And then you've got an equal playing field then.
Just Mike was on your last point, like the media did the same when Jodie Whittaker was announced as a son, just showed her topless, which was just, if nothing else, so what? She was topless in a role in a film.
I would love anybody that's listening, watching, tell me what you think of having a female doctor. I mean, I was thrilled when it was announced. And, you know, whatever you think of it, I think in a way they've made her job a little bit difficult because she's got so many companions. So some of the best lines that would normally go to the doctor, you know, Bradley is nicked and doing them wonderfully. But it does, it makes her job twice as hard, I think, because she's not driving quite so much of the wit, and the storyline. So she's had some of that responsibility taken out of her hands. But I think with the scripts she's got, she's been just fantastic.
That one's just going out to Andrew, who did ask a question about what you felt about a female doctor. And so we're just putting that up there. But I totally agree. I think it's she's doing a wonderful job with her performance. But yeah, that is very disheartening, especially when they've made this bold decision of having a female doctor finally. And then you give the best lines sometimes to Brodie Walsh, as you say. He's wonderful, but...
He's wonderful.
The doctor looking to him, which is just feels wrong to me.
Yeah, I think, yes, but it's very, very easy to sit here and criticise it, isn't it? I mean, the fact that it's still here and it's still going and it's still opening debate and it's still addressing very difficult, complicated issues. What a programme to be associated with. I'm so proud.
I only say my comments is encouragement for them to keep doing the work.
Yeah, I do completely.
Maybe we have a female showrunner next. Maybe that will help support a bit more.
Now, there's a thought.
It's great for us to make these bold moves as male showrunners to bring in a female doctor. But maybe a female showrunner might make more progressive steps still. Just saying. I'm just a really huge fan of K-9. But I know that was a very interesting dynamic to work with a prop, which... It could only move at a certain pace, and I believe that was sometimes interesting to work along when you had to run and then kind of stop for K-9 but make it look like you were still running. What was that like an experience?
We just got the technique down to a T, but wonderful John Leeson who was so gung-ho, so committed to the part, he would just run around the rehearsal room on all fours, because the BBC had this weird system whereby you rented your own props, so they couldn't afford to have K-9, the physical tin machine, in the rehearsal room. But we did have John Leeson, so he was just there on all fours. And before it went out on air, I used to snap my then dog. I had a dog called Bosie then. I used to snap my dog into rehearsals, going, "Oh, he's playing K-9. They didn't know till he went out. I'd be lying anyway.
Oh, someone just asked, this is a good question. Would you write for the main programme? Your scripts are so full of character and emotion.
Philip, how are you? That's Australia. Thank you for the compliment, Philip. I would absolutely write for the main programme if they asked me. Yeah, in a nanosecond.
And what do you think? What would you have? Just give your pitch right now. What instant story ideas do you have for Jodie?
Oh, right. Actually, I'm writing one for Tom at the moment. So I've got my head is for audio. So my head is kind of a bit full of that. But I think for Jodie, I think she's what Jodie's absolutely brilliant at is that full high powered energy thinking on the spot. So it might be interesting to do something that put her into slow motion. If you really put me on the spot here, but yes, something that would just slow her up completely so that she's working at 10% and for the others to have to solve it so that it becomes a very insular story rather than one that goes out to the universe. And maybe it's something to do with the very heart of the TARDIS. That she's not become disconnected with it. Something like that.
BBC, you've heard the pitch. Come on. what more do you need?
Oh, I'd have prepped a bit more if I'd known you were going to ask me that.
Look, that'd be off the top of your head. Think how wonderful it would be fleshed out. Come on, that's it. So come on, you go on this wild ride with Doctor Who over I forget how many years it was.
That I did with it. It was I think it was only about 10 months.
But
season and a half.
Was it your decision to step down, or was that kind of something which they had for the show? So how do you come about that decision? That has to be so tough as an actor.
Well, I was offered Portia in The Merchant of Venice at the Bristol Old Vic. So that was quite a big carrot to dangle my way at that age. What was I, 26, 27 then? So yeah, theatre beckoned. And I've never had like a career plan. The only thing I have tried to do is not stay longer than 2 years off a stage. And that could be a studio or a fringe or a room above a pub or a 5,000 seater. But I just think it keeps you match fit to get those words rock solid in your head and to be in front of a live audience.
I think it's something an actor's obviously got to do to keep on evolving, keep on doing new things, but it just must be a scary decision when you've got such a kind of hit, like the height of Doctor Who fame. Other than the only thing that's matched Tom Baker's reign as the Doctor is in recent years David Tennant, of course. So to leave something on the top of its game I would find that difficult anyway.
Yeah, I was ready, and I didn't feel at the time that Leela was being in any way developed. But you know, it's the nature of the beast is that the companion is there to say, "What is it, Doctor?" so that the Doctor can answer through the companion and let the audience know. So I was feeling a bit of a device rather than a, you know, fully fleshed out, developing character. But, you know, in a way, that's the same problem that you get in soap, isn't it? You can't have, like, as you say, you can't have, like, a personality change. You want to have something that grows, and it's quite, I mean, how much can she grow? The only thing she could do is get promotion, make him the assistant and her the running the TARDIS. Well, that wouldn't happen, would it?
yeah, no, it's true enough. But that does bring me into, I was going to move on to Big Finish next, and it's been very interesting, like, with Leela in Big Finish, not only do you get the character progression, which is more done in modern narrative and modern TV and audio, but it's also the fact that 1 week you can play one older version of Leela, the next week you could be another parallel version of an older version of Leela. I think Leela particularly, I can think of a few examples of where she's had a timeline which hasn't then hasn't stuck, shall we say. So how do you keep all that straight in your head? Like, which version of the character you're playing? Which kind of, like, how do you just keep that straight?
Well, there were all these different strands, weren't there? There was Gallifrey, you know, with lovely Lala. So that's going on its little journey. There's, of course, all the ones with Tom. I've also dotted about playing with various other doctors, just dipping into their timeline. And there's been all the Jay going out Lightfoot. And there's also been the Companion Chronicles. So you kind of hook into whichever of those strands you've gone into, and then look at who's written them, and then develop it that way. Just, you know, when she's back in her youth, I just technically just have to take the lower register out of my voice a bit, so I can, you know. But when she's older, I can just go back to this gravitas that's developed over the years. So there's a technical tricks that I can put in there, but yes, mainly to do with the rhythm of the writing. Each script's, I do a lot of prep. I'm a bit nerdy, geeky. I never go to it cold, so I'm in quite a good place to start with. I know where I'm coming from, where I've been, where I'm going to, what the objective is.
I find it also very interesting because, again, particularly with the character of Leela, you've got that side of her who is a warrior, and so you have to keep that kind of earthiness to it. But then when you're playing the older version or older versions of Leela, you bring in some wisdom, but it's kind of like it's both in the writing and performance, I have to say, it's very well done to have that balance between the two. I think that's really great.
I love it when they make her older. I have a real penchant for it. This is what I loved about the Omega Factor series that we did, that I'm still playing Dr. Anne Reynolds, but I'm allowed to be, I mean, I think she's supposed to be about 55 in that. And I love that. I'm not pretending to be back in my 20s again. Mind you, the power of audio, isn't it? The best films are made on audio, they say. So if people want to see me as 26 in their head, then, well, God bless you.
I nearly made a joke there, which was Philip Edney again. He's asked, "How was it working with John Hurt?" You'd worked with him on Shakespeare, hadn't you, previously?
No, I worked with him. I worked with John way back doing a play for Today called The Peddler. Play for Today, for those of you too young to remember, was a Wednesday night, 9 o'clock slot of an hour of new writing. I wish they'd bring it back. It was just such a glorious thing to do. And John Hurt played a salesman, and he had a one-night stand during the course of the play, and that was me. So I did some filming with him way, way, way back when, in the 70s, and then right at the beginning of my career, and then right at the end of his, was back with Big Finish. And that voice was the same before, since, during, you know, that gravelly voice. But that man's got pad charisma. I mean, you just knew he was in the room, even when he wasn't talking. He just had a manner of being that was... It exuded confidence, but you knew, you know, it's what I was talking about earlier, that actor's vulnerability. He just had a vulnerability about him, but a knowledge of his craft and how to hold the pause and how to deliver a line. Just beautiful.
I think what's so remarkable to me anyway, I mean, I was lucky enough, if I can point the correct direction because this flips me around, that's me with him just up there behind me there. I was lucky enough that you won't be able to probably see it on the camera, but I was lucky enough to meet him at a convention, and it's a very, very minor point, it might sound like, but I was dressed as Matt Smith, and I had my sonic screwdriver in my pocket, and he pointed, and instantly he recognised it as Matt's. He said, "Oh, that's Matt Sonic, isn't it?" And what really struck me, which kind of had struck me when he was talking in the extras and stuff, was how much he wasn't above anything. Like, you know, there's a lot of kind of actors still to this day who see sci-fi and then they look down that as a genre, as opposed to really looking at what the work's saying. And I think that's so remarkable when an actor of his stature knew it was still about what the script was saying, not about what the genre was. And I think that's great. Great.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. I might steal that. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You just springboard is your text. That's the kind of bottom line of everything, really. Yeah, and you either don't get in its way because it's so perfect, or you put a bit of technique on it to make it richer, or you do damage limitation on it. But it's all to do with the text.
Absolutely wonderful actor. Another one about someone else you work with in Big Finish. Alex Pass asks, "Leela and Derek Jacobi's Master was great fun. I would happily listen to a whole series there." Oh, okay, I suppose there's a question, but tell us a bit about working with Derek Jacobi.
Derek, I'll tell you another thing. I was on tour when we recorded that, and the only day I could record was a Sunday, and Derek came in on a Sunday to work with me because that was the only day I could make. He could easily have said no and recorded on a different day and then got the sound person to slot it all together, but he knows the value of bouncing off each other, so he came in on a Sunday to do that. Respect, huh?
I mean, the great Iggle Piggle himself.
Yeah.
again, no, I joke, but I think that it's the same thing. It's like someone who isn't above, oh, that's kids' TV. Like, he sees something which is fun to do, something which, yeah, and he goes for it. I love actors like that who aren't above any kind of medium of work.
Yeah. Completely. Yeah. And so modest and unassuming and quiet. I loved him.
Getting back to Big Finish, there's something wonderful, and you've already said it yourself, that about the breeding ground for talent, which it is, how they have someone who might come in as a writer and then they'll be directing and producing a series, and for yourself, you came in as an actor, obviously. Now you direct and write for them. How's it been kind of like, it seems like still learning always and getting those opportunities from Big Finish?
I wish I'd had this desire to learn that I have now when I was 15 or 16. this hunger for knowledge. I mean, it's so true that the more you know, the less you know. It's like you find out a fact and you think, oh no, that's another 10 books I've got to read before I fully understand that. And I feel Big Finish is a bit like that. And I, you know, the first writing gig they offered me, I then said yes, and I did it with my, because I'd written for theatre with Nigel Fairs, my writing partner. I'll do it with him. And then the next one they offered me, and he said, I want you to write, David Richardson said, I want you to write this one on your own. It was, he never orders anybody to do anything, but it was a bit of a directive. So I went, all right. And I had the wonderful Matt Fitton as a storyliner to see me through it. And then later John Dorney doing the same thing. So I feel like I've been paid to learn.
Yeah. And that's, I think it's about, you know, and again, it's something we spoke about earlier on. It's that whole idea that school sometimes can take the joy out of learning. And when it's learning for just the enjoyment and just the experience of it, it is so wonderful. I just really wish they could inject some of that into schools more often.
Yeah, I do too. I wonder if this lockdown will make a difference to that.
Unfortunately, I can only see it going the other way. I mean, I'm going to try and be as nonpartisan as I can. But the current government have put more of a push towards learning by rote, which I think takes a lot of joy out of learning. It's just like reading and repeating. It's echoing. It's not experiencing. Like, I'm someone who has dyslexia at school. Learning by rote was a killer for me. You know, if I got to actually experience something and feel part of it, like, you know, in oral presentations, I did a lot better than writing. And it feels like they're just going away from that more and more. And I think that's a great shame.
There's a marvellous book called The Gift of Dyslexia by Ron Davis, D-A-V-I-S, an American. If you don't know it, I highly recommend it to you. It's written in a very dyslexia, I'm dyslexic, written in a very dyslexia-friendly way. And it is a gift. It's a wonderful thing to be dyslexic, I think. But you're right, the schools don't gear itself to teaching a dyslexic because we're picked for things.
The one wonderful thing which I've learned more and more with, I've worked with some people with autism, and my son has autism, and I've learned through that of what a wonderful gift it is to make you think differently, and to give you other abilities than other people. Like, you may lose some on one end of the spectrum, but you gain so much on the other. And I think the same is true of dyslexia. I think dyslexic people think in a different way, and that's okay, and that's in fact really cool. But when you're at school, it just, you sort of learn, oh, that's okay, we'll work around your dyslexia, as opposed to, no, it's cool. Like, let's learn what you can do thanks to that different way of thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, to get it back to you, though.
I've just taken up piano lessons during the lockdown. And I did learn piano as a child. And I got up to grade 6. I got quite good. But I never coped with sight reading, because it just looked like scrambled egg on the page. And this course I'm doing is all to do with learning to play by ear, and learning to improvise, and learning jazz. And again, you know, I wish I'd had that as a child, as an alternative way. Or if I'd just been left alone with a piano, I would probably have played all through the years rather than stopped and picked it up again many years later.
We were mentioning your writing before, and Adele, there's a lot of questions about that. There is a question about if you're going to do any more, which we will get onto by Deborah Cook. Before that, though, tell us about writing it. Tell us about the At-Girl and the story behind that.
Well, I first heard about the Air Transport Auxiliary Women maybe 15 years ago now, and touted it around as a possible TV series. And they were a core group of 8 women headed by Pauline Gower, who said that women can do a man's job, and they could deliver these planes at times of war to the front line, to various factories around the country. And she fought long and hard and succeeded, and they experimented with these 8 women. By the end of the war, there were 110 women. I think it's a fantastic story. They were from all different walks of life. This is in real life. One came from a circus. One learned to fly so she could get away from her chaperone. She was a debutante. There were 2 sisters there that didn't really get on. Just great, interesting stories for each of them. And they were thrown together in this very dangerous, high adrenaline world. And much like Tenko, which was also a prisoner of war series that I was in, in 1981 we filmed that, we took real life stories and then we filtered them with fictional characters, all based on fact, and put them into a dramatic situation. And we've produced 6 episodes on audio, series of 4, followed by a series of 2. It just depends, to answer your question, Deborah, it just depends whether there's enough interest. If there's enough interest, we'll be writing more. So spread the word.
Yeah, download the audio now. Go to bigfinish.com, buy it now, and write to Big Finish saying how much you enjoyed it, and that's how you get more.
Yeah.
Take to Twitter. Yeah. Now.
You met my agent.
And the other thing which I thought was wonderful, which Big Finish did recently, was to do an audio drama which they recorded. Everyone recorded at home. I said to you before we went on, like, I had no idea it was recorded separately until the extras at the end. You wouldn't tell. I'm just so impressed by that level of ingenuity. How was that to record?
I was standing in a stairwell outside my bathroom with duvets and hat stands and, you know, to deaden the sound and a new microphone. I was terribly nervous. I've got it down to a dab hand now. I've got, you know, mocked up a home studio and I'm really quite good at it. And I've learned about WAV files and exporting and WeTransfer and all those things that I haven't got a clue about before lockdown. So I quite enjoyed that process of learning as well. But the first time was a bit, I was a bit nervous. I was a bit like, you don't want to be the one to muck up, do you? Everybody else seems to be handling it beautifully and you've forgotten to, you know, press the microphone on or something.
I mean, no matter how well everyone records it, though, just the work I know, which would have been, it would entail then putting that all together later, just a huge salute to the sound engineers at Big Finish.
Absolutely, and you can't underestimate them anyway under normal circumstances. Oh, no. They're like an extra character on the whole thing. And then really, the less you know they're there, the more brilliant they're being. You know, that's the irony of it. But it's, the way they put it together like a patchwork quilt, fantastic. I've also done a series called Poggy Wood, which isn't Big Finish, which is completely free. Completely free, written, devised, and put together by Nigel Fairs, who's done exactly that. He's been working with a dozen different actors every week and putting out the Poggy Wood Murders, and it's like Agatha Christie meets Carry On. Basically, it's like a send up.
Where can we find the Paddley Wood Murders? Did you say
it's on Spotify? Or iTunes, it's all over the place.
Check that out now. And another thing which you've done remotely, which I did mention up top, and I just want to call this up so I can properly credit the person behind it. So it was Ian Winterton who very kindly set this up today, and he worked on Stuart and Dumplings with you, which you produced over Zoom, I believe that was recorded.
Yes. Such a lovely thing to do. I got sent this script, really sweet script, and at the time I was missing my grandchildren like anything when I got the script, because it was before restrictions were lifted a bit. And the premise is that it's a grandmother with a grandson in his late 20s who has Down syndrome, and she's terribly worried about him being able to cope on his own. And that's what the Zoom's about. They have this meeting where she's teaching him to cook stew and dumplings, which he's nicknamed Stuart and Dumplings. And it's not, you know, it's not any sort of major drama. It's just a sweet little window on this family's life. And the marvellous Mina Anwar plays a social worker who also comes in on our Zoom meeting just to check that Stuart's all right and that grandma's all right, and we have a bit of an argument and there's a bit of tears, but it's just simply this boy coping and cooking his own supper. And that's all the story is, but it's an absolutely delightful, tenderly written piece.
Yeah, I mean, I did a couple of years stint as a support worker myself, and I just really love the truth of it. Like, it just really, really steps through to me. Knowing the people who I'd worked with who kind of had different abilities, and how it was so nerve-wracking whenever they got a new ability. Not for them, for us. Like, for anyone who's around them who wanted them to succeed, was so nervous for them. And you'd see how much the families would struggle with that. And, you know, they of course wanted their person to thrive. But it's so nerve-wracking when they're doing stuff for themselves. So the way you portrayed that really stuck true to me.
Oh, thank you. It's very hard, isn't it, if you have a challenged child. It's very hard to cut the umbilical cord, metaphorically.
Yeah.
To be able to go, you're launched. You know, let me glory in your flight. And I can see that that's a really important debate to be had within that.
And Mina, totally nailed being a social worker, just looking very tired through it. Because I mean, on a good day, that is a nightmare and wonderful job all at the same time. Like, the pressure is just on them. So it's just a wonderful thing to highlight at this time, which I don't think it ever highlighted enough.
Well, we had our rehearsal and we all dressed, you know, as we thought would be suitable. And we, you know, put the camera where we thought it would work. I actually took it down to my living room rather than had it here in my office. And she was going, "This all right, is it? This all right? No makeup, looking tired."
And the young man, I'm sorry, very stupidly not written down his name, the young man playing Stuart, can you talk a bit about
Sam Barnard? Absolute delight. And, you know, Lions Learn on it, he was incredibly compliant, every piece of direction he was given, nothing. And it's really, really hard to cook, hit a mark and deliver your lines. It's a tough call because you're working on three different levels all the time, finding the camera. And, you know, you've only got this one camera. So you have to be very careful to stay in profile or stay to reveal the pot while you're cooking it. So he was really, it was fine for Mina and I. We just had to sit still, basically. And I had, my glasses and the handkerchief, but that was about it. But he had salt, pepper, which were Dalek shaped, by the way.
Yeah, lovely little touches there.
He had meat, he had to chop vegetables, he had the knife, the chopping board, the pot. He had to literally cook it while we were doing it, had the flame on. I mean, difficult job. And, you know, respect, all credit to him, he just landed it.
Yeah, if anyone wants to catch it, go to YouTube now, Stuart and Dumplings, Stuart. Absolutely wonderful production. And one thing I do like to do with any of my guests is just to ask for a little bit of advice to make me and my listeners just better at everything we do. So the thing I'd like to ask you, given that you have produced this, and I'm in a position as probably some of my viewers and listeners are, where we sometimes have to ask people to be in things that we've produced, what is your advice for someone approaching someone like yourself about being in something that they've made or coming to do an interview or anything like that?
Well, first of all, I'd say ask, you know, and ask with respect, obviously, you know, find not a bombarding way, but, find an email, approach on Twitter, do a private DM, something like that. Because, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen is they go, "No, sorry, too busy, this isn't for me." That's the worst thing that can happen. But if you don't ask, you don't get. So that would be my first. And also get rid of negative thoughts. "Oh, she'll never say yes." Just get rid of that. She might say yes. Just replace it with that. She might not, but she might.
It's a nice way to look at it. But before we go, just quickly, can you just tell us a bit about where we can find you online? So I've got louisejameson.com ready.
You want me to repeat that? Sorry.
Oh, no, just anywhere else we can find you online? Anything you want us to look out for?
Right, yes, Secret Life of Boys, CBBS. I'm a granny with a Harley Davidson in that. The lovely, it's been a lovely gig. And I'll let you know about the sitcom when and if it happens, so you can give me a little plug.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So for anyone who is watching, you can listen to this back later on audio. Please go to drsquee.com. Just go to your favorite podcatcher or podcast app and you can listen to our previous episodes, which has such people as Paul Haggis, award-winning writer and Bond writer. We've got my first interview for this show was with the late, great Tim Brooke Taylor just before he passed away. Lots of good stuff there. And so please check us out. Please subscribe. And yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
So, from me, Dr. Squeak, from my guest this week, Louise Jameson, if I can point the right way because this thing flips me around.
I can't do it either. It's our brains.
Have a wonderful day. That was the Dr. Squeak Show. I've been Dr. Squeak, and this was my show.